Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, well, welcome everybody. It was about 10 minutes before the sit started. I walked by the Dhamma hall and I saw Moria sitting there. She was the only one in the hall. And I thought, oh, maybe we'll have to cancel the afternoon program and no one's here. Turn around, there's 30 people here, so it's nice seeing everybody here. Also, quite a few faces I don't think I've seen before. Is this anybody's like first time here? Are you here as a group, or did you just all spontaneously show up? Kind of. Well, welcome. I was kind of contemplating earlier today that mostly what I've been sort of contemplating the last couple of weeks, we've been talking every morning. We have, right before our work period, starts in the work period, we have a morning reflection. And so myself and the other monks have been talking about mindfulness practices, and that's what I talked about last week, some insights I had on a retreat that I had attended. And then last night, Ajahn Kurunadamo gave a really quite detailed account of sort of like, you know, how to use mindfulness. It's almost like a, kind of a minute sort of second by second, sort of mind moment by mind moment, what's happening in the mind and how to use that. And so kind of I was thinking of even telling some more stories about that, but it's almost like if you weren't here for all of the previous talks, it's oftentimes when I do give a talk, I feel like I'm talking to the monastic community, but as you see right now, if you've been here before, we're quite diminished. The abbot is in Washington, D.C., doing some teachings there, meetings, and Ajahn Kurunadamo is at Spirit Rock giving a day-long there, and he took several of the community members with him as well, so a lot of people are traveling. But I don't normally do this, but I kind of thought maybe, especially it kind of seems like it might be a good thing to do since there's so many people who've never been here before. Just actually open this up for question and answers, just if, any sort of questions you might have. What is a monastery? Like, I don't know what your, associations with monasteries are. If you have meditation practice and heard about us, or if you have questions about mindfulness, or I'll just open it up, and if nothing does come up, I'll talk to you about mindfulness. So I have something in mind, but just is there any, especially those who've never been here before, if there's any questions. Yeah.
What is your practice like
here? Yes, yeah. One way of answering that is like everything about being here is our practice. And so we do have a routine, and so during the normal part of the week, we'll do. We get together at 5 in the morning, and we'll meet here for chanting, and then like an hour meditation, and then after that, we have a quick half-hour chore period where we're just kind of keeping the monastery nice and neat, sweeping, or someone's preparing breakfast, and people doing garbage, and all just the daily things that have to happen to keep an institution running. Then have a very light breakfast, like a half hour, usually like oatmeal and a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. Then we have a meeting where we one monk is responsible for kind of all the work that happens in the monastery. And so it's a pretty kind of stressful job where he's got to figure out the entire schedule for the year, what has to happen, and how to get that accomplished. And that's a training there, and for like the community members, is we don't really have much say in what we do. And so it's like if the work monk decides that, today we're going to be, clearing out dead brush from cooties and really hard physical work, but it's already 80 degrees and 9 in the morning. It's like, no, that's what you're doing, you know. And so it's a learning to sort of flow with whatever happens, you know, if we like it or not. And then so there's the morning work period. It's about 2.5 hours usually, so it's not a huge amount of work, but 2.5, 3 hours. Then we have our main meal at 11 in the morning, and usually by the time the meal's done, clean up, it's usually around 12:30 or 1 o'clock. And then the rest of the afternoon usually is free time. So all the residents, monks and lay guests who stay here, we live in pretty small cabins, basically like 100 square feet, kind of 8 by 10 or 10 by 10 kind of size cabins. And some of them are just a few-minute walk from here. But some of them are like 15, 20-minute walk. And so it's a lot of, you know, spend most of the time in the afternoon out in the forest at our cabins. And each of the cabin has a walking meditation path. And so it's about 50 feet long. So when we go out there, you can spend it however you wish to do it, meditation, study, doing walking meditation. Or there's also lots of trails here. There's probably 3 or 4 miles worth of trails, and you can walk up to the ridge, and there's actually two monasteries that touch our property. One's a kind of retreat center, another Buddhist monastery, kind of that direction, and there's a Christian monastery over here, and so you can kind of wander off onto their property a little bit as well, and if you go for a longer walk. So, yeah, afternoons, though, are completely usually unstructured. And then 5:30, there's a tea, and one of the senior monks, if not the abbot, will meet over in one of the other buildings for people to have questions. And so it's an opportunity every day that people have to make contact or ask questions. And then during the typical day, at 7 o'clock, we have an evening puja. So the same thing that we just did now, except there wouldn't be a Dhamma talk at the end of it. There'd be a chanting and meditation. Then we're pretty much encouraged to be in silence from that point on until the next morning after the morning reflection. So about 12 hours, you're really encouraged to be in silence and not on the computers, not doing any kind of work like that or talking to people. So it's kind of a nice, the daily routine's this nice sort of coming together, working together, going off, being alone again in silence, and you're doing your own thing, then coming back together for communal activity, then going back out on your own. So it's this sort of nice give and take and flow that way. And oftentimes, though, there are going to be other twice a week, now we're doing that on Sunday, so there's this meditation with the Dhamma talk at the end of it, and we go by instead of going by the Sabbath being a Sunday, we go by the lunar calendar, and so once a week we have this kind of same format, but it happens at 7:30 in the evening, and then on those nights, most of the time we stay up all night long and stay up at least till 3:30 in the morning, and it's a practice of patience and putting forth effort and giving up comforts, and so instead of sleeping, we stay up till 3, and then we do our morning chanting at 3, and then you have 3:30, everything's wrapped up. If you wish to go back to your cabin, you can go back and get some sleep. The next day after that, there's usually nothing scheduled except for the kitchen manager has to prepare or figure out how to make sure there's a meal offered that day. But other than that, the schedule's usually really quite open. And so that's kind of the routine. But, you know, the training then comes in like all the various aspects. It's not just the meditations. Part of the monastic form that we are part of, the Thai forest tradition, they place a lot of emphasis on the rules and sort of etiquette of living in a monastery. And so as a fully ordained monk, the ones of us that have the robes here on the shoulders were fully ordained. And then Tisaro there is a novice, has 10 precepts. And then Gary is in white, and he lives by 8 precepts. So they're both in the beginning stages of the training. But we spend a fair amount of time during the year going over all the different rules and the monastic etiquette, and so there's training in that sense in terms of studying the rules, going over them, and then just as the daily life, it's like with all of us, we're sort of helping each other out with the training and pointing out the different. For us that are fully ordained, we have 227 precepts that we follow, but one of the previous abbots, Ajahn Amaro, used to point out there's 227 rules, but there's probably 10,000 sort of etiquette rules, of little things like the books, or we set them on this little cloth instead of setting them on the ground, sort of out of respect for Dhamma books, or for the senior monks, we put these waters out for them because they're speaking, they might need to have water. And so there's all these sort of little etiquette things that we do that we really pay attention to. And so a lot of the training is learning how to give feedback, because it's really difficult sometimes to want to point things out to people or to say things. And so it can be a tendency, let's just not deal with that. But it's part of our monastic etiquette, and part of our rules is that we do give feedback, and we learn how to do that. And so that's the training. And then receiving feedback is another, sort of how do you receive it? And and there's actually rules about how to, because obviously even during the time of the Buddha, it's like people gave feedback and then people retaliated, and so there's certain rules about how to receive feedback back, and a lot of the training comes in like looking at not getting things the way we want them, because it's a by putting ourselves into a form. I think that's like how the biggest way the training happens, is putting ourselves into the monastic form. Then, like the day is, like I say, I showed you, it's really regimented. There's this time is for this time for this, and it's like my personal sort of inclination of what works for me. We do get periods of time, like during the summer, we'll get 2 weeks where we can just be completely on our own. We don't have to come down for the work period or anything. It's 2 weeks solo retreat. And almost always when I start doing this, the first night to be here at 5 in the morning, normally you have to get up about 4. You have to be doing some stretching and get down here and be ready so you get up at 4. And so the first mornings I have when I don't have to do that, it's like my natural inclination is to stay up till about midnight and then maybe get up at 5 the next morning, and then the next night I'll be up till 2, and then maybe get up around 6, and it keeps getting later and later and later. So my natural inclination is I'm a completely a night person, and so and that's just like what works for me. But I choose to live here in this community, and I choose to live here. And then the morning puja starts at 4, so even though like my sort of like favorite time to be awake and to be meditating is like say 10 o'clock at night till about 2 in the morning, I know I can't do that when I live here, because it's just that's gonna make it really difficult to make it to the morning pujas if I did that. So a lot of it is learning to set aside what it is we want to do and to learn how to be comfortable with that. I was just telling somebody recently that when I was during our third year as a monk, second or third year as a monk, we get to travel to a different monastery. We found in the early days with some of the other monasteries is that if you kind of do all your training in one monastery, it takes about 5 years really to sort of get comfortable with it, to know really what all the rules are, and not even know what they are, but really how to use them as skillfully. So it's not a like this is do's and don'ts, but like how does it support your meditation practice? How does the form support you? What we found was that if you do all your training in one place and never get a chance to leave, it's like after you've been a monk for 5 years, you do have the option of going wherever you want to. And we kind of do that with permission from the abbot. Like it's if we value it here and we want to spend most of our life here or train here, like if I were just to say, well, I'm going to go off to Australia and just leave, Well, the abbot might say, you're welcome to leave, but you're not welcome back if they don't get his permission. So we do things, you know, in harmony. But after the fifth year, you tend to have a lot more freedom. But what we found was is if you kind of feel like you're stuck in one place, after you get that 5 years, you leave and they never come back. And so, not here, but in other monasteries. So a lot of the monasteries start experimenting with, in Thailand it's easy to do because you have hundreds of monasteries, so you can send people around to various teachers. But in the West, it's harder. So we started during our third year to let people have an option of going to various monasteries. And a lot of them, these two, actually three of us all chose to go to Thailand, but some of the monks recently have been going to Canada to live with Ajahn Viradhamo or other monasteries. But so we get a year to be away, just experience monastic training someplace else. And forget where I was going with that story. It's already got a little too detailed. But so just with the, you know, this 5 years of training, though, it's like, you know, a lot of it is that you learn how to use the rules and how to have it support you, and I totally forgot where I was going with that story, but I'll open up for more questions. Yeah, Sam.
I have a question about Buddhist perception of God, and as I understand, there is no God in Buddhist philosophy, theology. However, there are certain supernatural beliefs, such as rebirth and karma and things that are outside the natural observable world.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could please explain if there is a concept of God, what is it, and if not, what are the things outside of the body and the mind and the natural world that is part of the belief system of Buddhism?
Yeah. I think one thing that attracted me to Buddhism, and I think a lot of people, is that it's really not a belief system. You know, it's not like you have to take on a set of beliefs. The way I kind of always saw it was just sort of like, well, try it and see. Take the teachings, you know, what the Buddha said, and try them out and actually see if they work for you. It doesn't really matter if you believe it or not. And that was one thing that kind of attracted me to Buddhism initially. I've also been a little bit, haven't done so much recently, but been involved with, say, Buddhist intermonastic religious dialogue, so basically with Catholic monks, and many of them have very good meditation practices, and a lot of them are really, even like the monks next door at Mount Tabor, a lot of them are pretty well read on Buddhism and meditation. You know, they I think their, you know, their worldview is very, very different than mine, I think at one level, like you could say, the Christian concept of God, but one thing is like when I talk to a lot of the Christian monks, it's like I don't think that their views are as like black and white like that. Like, you know, I really doubt that any of them sort of feel like, you know, like the sort of image of God as being this old man with a beard sitting on a cloud. You know, probably none of them actually believe that. You know, so it's a Ajahn Amara once was said he was down in San Francisco and before Bhaiagiri was founded, but the Sanghapala board was inviting him over every year just to see how the monastics would, you know, if it would work in the United States. And he was once said he was confronted by some people when he was on alms round, and they were asking him, you know, if he believed in God. And then it was like three or four of them, and he asked them, he says, well, what do you mean by God? And they, you know, not a single one of them agreed. You know, so they were kind of, you know, challenging him, but he was like, but, well, what do you mean by God? And then they couldn't answer the question. So it's like this sort of, you know, unquestioned assumption. You know, it's like, one way I have no idea myself either, but like one way of looking at God is like it's Dhamma. You know, it's just the truth, or, you know, it's like, it's a universal principle that that you know, we either understand or don't understand or awaken to or not awaken to. So and the second part of the question was more like about kind of...
Yeah, I understand about it's all experiential, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Buddhism encourages investigation
mm-hmm.
of your own mind and so on. But then there are certain concepts such as karma and rebirth
mm-hmm.
that are hard to experience individually, if not impossible to experience.
Right.
And so maybe if you could just explain those concepts and the beliefs of both karma and rebirth and the deathless also.
Yeah.
That would be helpful.
Yeah, those are just in 5 minutes, yeah. Yeah. But, well, actually, karma is like, it's funny, it's like, you know, at a very basic level, it's like, you know, people either, they, I think like a lot of teachings, a lot of things people like, you know, it's like, we set things up as like, it's either believable or not believable, yes or no, black or white. It's like, I don't think it's just American society, but I think a lot of the world is that way. It's just sort of, you know, it's either yes or no, black or white. And so, like, you know, you ask someone like, you know, do you believe in karma? So, you know, is the answer is yes or no. But what do you mean by karma? You know, again, asking that question, sort of contemplating. You know, I think a lot of people who have a response to that have really no idea what you're actually referring to as karma. And because karma actually, in the Pali sense and the way we talk about it in the Thai forest tradition, it just means action. Karma is action. So it's like, do you believe in action? You know, if we translate it. But what I think a lot of people, when they say they don't believe in karma, what they're saying is they don't believe in vipaka, vipaka karma. That's the results of actions. So people don't believe that there's a predetermined, result from any given action. And so, I would tell people like, well, you go to work. Do you believe you're going to get a paycheck? Well, the paycheck is vipaka karma. It's the result of having put forth effort. And so, you know, so it's like, it is true that you can't, it's easy for people to say that they don't believe in karma, because it's not so simple as like, you know, so like if I'm kind to you, that there's, you know, I can never know what the result of that is going to be. You know, it's probably going to be something wholesome or something good. You could also do something that, you know, could be quite mean to somebody. You know, it could be your intention to be mean, but it actually might wake them up, you know, to something like, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that, you know, or they might be really wise and be able to use that internally, and it might be really skillful for them. But but for you internally, that's not a good thing because you are acting on anger. You're acting on unskillfulness. So it's karma is, the Buddha said it's actually impossible to actually figure it out, to actually to know the results of what your actions are going to be. So in that sense, it is kind of, you can't map it out. Like if I do X, Y, and Z, then these are going to be the results. And like I've heard some teachers like say that, you know, they have a, you know, like if you do believe in rebirth or if it does actually exist, then it's like the karmic results of any action are also being affected by everything else we've done in the past as well. So like, yeah, just like I might be nice to you, and that's going to have a different karmic effect if I've always been nice to you, because then it's like, then you're going to, you know, trust me. But if I've always been mean to you, and then all of a sudden one time I'm nice, it's like you might kind of, well, it was different, but you're not going to believe it or you're not going to respond to it. So it's like all of your actions in your past also affect that one moment in the present. So so you can see it's a really very complex, you know, system. And so, yeah, if there's such things as past lives too, it's like, this one teacher I remember hearing saying that, like, the Buddha says that, like, if you are able to, you know, establish your mindfulness, you know, really, really strongly, you know, it's like, or actually if you become a stream enter, like, if you actually do totally understand what, you're breaking through greed, hatred, and delusion to the sense that you become a stream enter, which is the first stage of enlightenment, you can still be reborn up to 7 times. So it's almost like the karmic consequences that we perform kind of have like a really strong influence in the, like in 7 lifetimes. And so it's like, you can almost look at it as like, you know, if we can't quite understand like our own personalities or why we act the way we do, or why we have these tendencies, it's probably because it's being affected by our previous seven lifetimes. And so, if that's true or not, I don't actually know. But it's interesting for me. It's like, you know, talking about like, say, not self, the teaching of not self, and the kind of some of the basics or premises of Buddhism is looking at dukkha, anicca, and anatta. So that suffering exists in the world, that everything is changing, and that things aren't like who and what we think. We aren't really who and what we think we are, so like anatta. And my very first meditation retreat, I actually came to Buddhism. I don't want to get into this during the question and answer period, but I came to Buddhism because of a near-death experience. And for about, that was about 3 or 4 days, I knew that I could die at any moment. I was just like, I had altitude sickness hiking in the Himalaya Mountains. And the very last day of this, I had this extreme pain, just like way off the charts of what I would consider what most people think it was, extreme pain. And I remember thinking to myself, I wanted the pain to end. But before I could actually form the entire thought, this voice from outside me came in and said, if you wish for that, you're dead. And is that what you want? And I was like, no. And it was interesting because my first thought was is that I still had to ask forgiveness from my parents for some just ways that I had been. Nothing terrible, but it's just like, you know, I haven't appreciated them enough. You know, and it's like, yeah, if I have the opportunity, I want to do that. And so, but I said, but this pain is so unbearable, I need to be separated from it. And as soon as I said that, that like became my intention. I came out of my body. And at the time, it was I was extremely materialistic. I was in my mid-20s, and just like I motivated myself by making money so I could buy toys or do things, and kind of had this belief that like those toys were who and what I was, you know, like very materialistic, and that just really just, you know, completely shook me. And then and I kind of, you know, during this out-of-body experience, the only thing I could identify with is like, say, who and what I thought I was. Because I had eyesight, I had vision, and I had thought. Somebody else pointed out later that I had a sense of self, which I thought was interesting. But like everything else physically, like the weight, the body, the sound, taste, you know, everything tactile, you know, all of that was completely gone. It was just vision and thought. And so the first time I heard the Buddhist teachings, I was at a Galenka retreat, and I sat. I was very fortunate to sit it with like four or five really good friends, and we were driving back to this ashram we lived at, and we started talking about the teachings, and it was funny because one thing they pointed out, all of them was like, man, I just could not get music out of my head, you know, like the whole retreat, I just kept hearing music, and I was like, I'm not musical at all. And I used to always beat myself up because I could never join in when people started singing songs at parties and stuff. And here I was like, I didn't hear a sound. That was great. I had thoughts, but didn't hear any music. But the biggest thing they objected to was this, the sense of not self, the teaching of not self. And I was like, what do you mean? Isn't it obvious? You know, it's because of that near-death experience and just, you know, really experiencing the body is not being the self. It's not to say I'm enlightened or anything, but sometimes these things actually can be experienced. Those kind of teachings, you can't experience dukkha, you can't experience change, and you can't experience the not self. A lot of it is just like part of like we were talking about the training is getting out of ourself in the training. You asked the question the other night, tea time, about the bodhisattva vow, right? Yeah, and so it's kind of the same. Same kind of thing. A lot of the like anattas, like we can experience that when we set aside what it is we want to do. You know, what it is that our wishes. I think that's where kind of was going with one of the questions. The first question there is the training is to, if we just can bring ourselves into the present moment and see what's needed and what's helpful and you know, like we might have a desire like, yeah, I need to get up, go use the restroom, but okay, we're in the middle of a meditation set. If I get up and leave and open the door, it's going to be disturbing for people. So I'll just, you know, I can wait. So I'll wait. And so it's, you know, like looking at setting aside what we want to do for the whole, the, you know, the good of the whole. And if you can do that and train yourself to do that, it does, it's not like something you have to will yourself to do. It just becomes, that's the natural inclination. So a lot of the training for the, again, going back to training for a lot of the monks is that, especially if you're like a junior community member, it's like we train ourselves into trying to pay attention to what, like say Ajahn Pasano or Ajahn Sek, you know, with the senior monks, what their needs are. So like if the morning announcements are being read, like you're listening to, you know, obviously what you have to be aware of, what you have to do for yourself, but you're also listening like, oh, Ajahn Pasano is traveling tomorrow. Well, that means he probably needs laundry done. Or, you know, the next day he's going to be gone, so I can actually get over to his cabin and I can clean it while he's gone. And so you're actually, you know, planning your day based on other people's needs, not on your own. And some of the monks, you're like, you know, take that on really well. And it just becomes second nature to them. And it really is. It's a, yeah, you're viewing the world from somebody else's perspective. And so you drop that sense of self easier. Yeah. Any other questions? Or yeah.
So just kind of to that point, one thing I've always had a hard time wrapping my head around is the teaching of anatta and the teaching of rebirth and how conceptually they kind of fit in together. Because if there is no self, then what is it that lives on to another life?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I'm actually really qualified to answer it totally, but one way I look at it is it's a like anatta, not self, doesn't mean that there's not a self. The teaching isn't no self; it's a not self, and so it's more like we pick things up, and like I say with my toys, like, you know, those things did exist. And I was technically the owner of them, but they weren't. You know, they're not me. They're not self. And so it's not saying that they don't exist, but so it's kind of looking at it that way. It's not self, not no self, and then sort of like rebirth. One way of looking at it is I heard, I think it was Stephen Levine. I didn't hear him say this, but I heard him being quoted as saying this. But is like actually what's being reborn is our intentions. And so it's like, you know, whatever, and that's kind of back to the question about karma as well. So it's like, even though karma is action, it, you know, over lifetimes then develops, you know, particular patterns and habits. And so it's a, the habits that we have, that's, you know, propels us into the next moment. So, like, I like talking about it like if someone were to come in right now, it's like, you know, someone just off the street came in and had some radically different views that we did, and started yelling at us. You know, like if we were to then respond to him with anger, then the next time that situation happens, we'll probably respond with anger again because we're conditioning ourselves to respond that way. But if someone came in and everybody here might have a really negative perception to it, but then Tansudiro here just sort of jumps up and says, "Oh, are you okay? You know, is everything okay? You know, you seem to be, you know, something's disturbing you. Please come sit down. Can we get you some water?" And then all of us would learn from that experience. And then the next time it happened, all of us might have the next time something like that happened, our reaction would be more kindness. And so so it's like that, you know, to me that's sort of like, that's karma, you know, in the present moment. But then what Stephen Levine pointed out is like, you know, so like right now it's like we're alive and our momentum's going in a particular direction, but boom, you're dead. But there's the next moment after that. And so whatever your intention was, like right before I snapped my finger, if it was boredom or judgment or intrigued what he was saying, you know, like whatever that moment was, it's like that next moment of rebirth is going to be highly conditioned by that last thought. So it's like, and that's why it's like it's really good to, you know, like live by precepts and you know, have that really skillful intention. It's not that we're always going to be skillful or always be able to, you know, be saints, but if our mind is always going towards, you know, like, well, how do I help people or how do I do things that don't harm, it's much more likely at the moment of death. Like you might live an entirely unskillful life, but you know, if your mind for some reason got really lucky at the very end, and Ajahn Pasana was there doing chanting for you, and you had a happy moment at death. It's like, well, that's going to highly influence your next life, but it'd be easier to have that happy moment if you spent most of your life with Ajahn Pasana. So that's how not self and reincarnation, my understanding of it anyway. Yeah, in the back there. Yep.
My question is about what separates lay people from monks, like if it's kind of deeper. If you feel like there's, in your opinion, like a calling? Like a calling?
Yeah.
Or like you're dealing with some kind of pain, like you said that you had a near death experience?
Yeah.
If your environment is so contrived, how do those skills translate into the quote unquote real world? I mean, I know you're mm-hmm. in the real world in the monastery, but like,
yeah.
Where does it go out?
Yeah.
What does it prove? How does it apply?
Yeah, that's good questions. Yeah, yeah. So in terms of say monastic or lay person, and one kind of thing that the Buddha said is that anybody can become enlightened. So it's like it's not the lay people can't, or you can only do it as a monastic. So it's like there's a in that sense there's not really any difference there. It's like there's lots of probably thousands of lay people who actually understand the Buddha's teachings in terms of academically better than I do. And so, in terms of learning or even ability to meditate, so that doesn't really have anything to do with the monastic form. But I think the one thing that the monastic form does do is that it gives you an environment in which that it's actually easier to be able to meditate, to be able to have that time to study. So we don't have to spend 8 or 12 hours a day working every day and fighting traffic and dealing with domestic issues, and so it is a sacrifice. Yeah, so we give up the intimate relationships and the freedom that you have of owning possessions or owning money to be able to go and do what we want. So it can be there's trade-offs, but what we do get is if we do value sort of meditation or what you can get from that, then being a monastic gives you that support. And so it's like that's a quick answer to that. And then how we affect the world, I think is one way of kind of rephrasing that question, is that the way I always see a Bhagiri is like we're developing, I think we're about 150 acres of land here. It's like we're creating a refuge where people can come to that want to get away from, come to a place where there is sanity, where there is you come here. The name of the monastery is Abhayagiri, which is Abhaya is fearless and Giri is mountain, so it's like fearless mountain. But Ajahn Pasana often refers to it as a place where you need no fear. It's a Giri mountain, so it's a place, place where you need no fear. So it is a place where people can come and feel safe. And I was here when right after September 11th, 2001, and I remember right before because everybody, of course, filled churches and places of kind of worship. And I remember Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasana encouraging us not to actually bring it up as a subject. Like if people wanted to ask us our opinion or talk about it or process that we can listen or offer our feedback, but not to be actually sort of bringing it up as a conversation, because they kind of had the insight that a lot of people are just going to want to come here because they're probably getting over inundated by the media or the news be a place where they can come and drop that. And so at one level, that's why I see what we do as monasteries, is we're creating a place where people can have that freedom and that safety. It's also a place, though, it's like the Bhagiri in general. I think what we do, we're kind of unique even in the Ajahn Chah lineage, is that we, the whole monastery has been set up as a training facility for monastics. And so, it is it's not like a monk factory, but it is a place where people want to come in and try, to be an anagarika for a year, or try being a novice. They can come and there's that space to do that. And so it's like, yeah, even if we just produce one person who's peaceful and calm and put them out in the world, then to me that's a lot of value putting out there in the world. Giving that kind of an example. And also too, it's like, a Bhagiri exists because people asked us to be here. And so, like, I couldn't, I grew up in Indiana, so I just couldn't tomorrow to say, okay, I'm moving back to Indiana and I'm going to start a monastery. And so when we start a monastery, like I mentioned Ajahn Amaro being down in San Francisco and the people asking him, do you believe in God? It's like he was there because there was the group that's our board of directors, Sangapala Foundation. They had invited Ajahn Amaro to, Ajahn Sumedho actually, to come and start a monastery here. And so what they did is Ajahn Sumedho started sending over a couple of monks or a couple of nuns every year, and just to be here for like a 3-month period, just to see if there really was the interest, how much support there would be. But it was also for that community to find out if really this was the right monastic community for them, because there's different forms of Buddhism and people teach in different ways. And so it was an opportunity for both sides to kind of see if there, if there was enough support. And then when they kind of realized it was, then we slowly started building this. So like the same thing, like if I wanted to start a monastery in Indiana, which I don't, but if I did, it'd be like, there would have to be an invitation there, and then it slowly comes about from that. So like partly why Bhagiri is here is because the lay community wanted it to be here, and so so with that comes responsibilities from both communities. So it's like, because we don't do anything to earn money, we don't we even teach retreats and we give Dhamma books away and we have a really good website, and so but not everything on that's free. We don't advertise on the website, or there's no money coming into the monastery. So that's like a real teaching there in and of itself. It's like none of us get a salary, there's no retirement fund for us. It's like we're doing this because for liberation. And so it's kind of an example to the world as well. It's like that we're living by different world, different values, different value system, and kind of trying to live that ourselves. But then hopefully that can make an effect in the world as well. But then the people that support the monastery, it's like encourages generosity. So it's like everything, all this construction that's happening, that all just came from free will donations. There's even the middle of this huge construction site, there's not a single poster up here saying that, we need this much more money, a thermometer with how much money we need to get. None of that's there. It's all about providing the situation, and those that benefit from it or want it, then they it teaches them to step forward to provide food or provide money for the utilities or the buildings, the health insurance or whatever it is.